Blog Talk Radio.
You think they really ready for you now? Nah. You think that there'll be many of you now? Nah. Do you really think they ready for you now? Nah. You think they really ready for you now? Nah. You think that there'll be many of you now? Nah. Do you really think they ready for you now? Nah.
Charismatic and all that. He just was. Even when he sung the national anthem, I mean, it was Marvin Gaye. You know, it was just unique. It was special.
Can you see through the perilous fight
The man you're about to see and hear, should you be so foolish as to have just joined us, is Ray Charles.
Hello. All right. 3, 4.
I got something, y'all, in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to sing along. Lift every voice and sing, till I did heaven ring, ring with the harmony, oh, liberty. Let our rejoices rise high, burning the clouds, south as the sea. God of our weariness, God of our solitudes, thou who hast brought us this far.
Get off with the weekend review, but I'm going to do that at the end of the show, the weekend review. Yeah, I'm going to throw a little Beyonce in there for you Beyonce people. You know, she got a text from Dana, she's not showing off because Beyonce turned her lights off too. But that's neither here nor there. We're kicking off our Black History Month show with a tribute to Carter G. Woodson. We also are going to take a look at how the FBI spied on blacks in the 60s and kind of destroyed the movement. I'm going to have some excerpts from Dr. Claude Anderson to see where are blacks going in the future. So, Carter G. Woodson, the father of African American History Week, then the month, Miseducation of Negro, another book he wrote. I'm going to try to have maybe a day where I play the whole audio version so everybody can hear what the struggles blacks were back into then. I'm going to play two little tributes of Carter G. Woodson. So I'm saying two because they might overlap on saying some of the same things, but each one is a little different. Jimmy's Underground Radio, 347-838-9825.
Think of the worst things people can say about your culture, about your race, about your religion, about your people. Are they true? Could it be that you're not as smart, or you're money hungry, or you're a drunk, or you're cold and calculating? Of course not. You're an individual. Chances are your culture has made contributions in a masterful way to cultures throughout the world. But the more the bigots say it, the more it seems true. The more these stereotypes are hoisted upon the cultural landscape, the more people look at blacks and Jews, Muslims, Catholics, Native Americans, Asians, and Hispanics with wary eyes, wondering if the demonizing insults are true. How in the world can you believe in yourself if those around you believe you're a lesser life form? Dr. Carter G. Woodson had an answer for that. That answer is knowledge.
What, you may ask, is so important about studying history? The answer is as simple as it is important. If you knew your culture's history was directly linked to great writers, powerful leaders, successful business people and pioneers, wouldn't that make you proud? Wouldn't that inspire you to do great things yourself? Those who endeavor to understand their own history are paving a path toward a bright future. Carter G. Woodson, the father of black history, knew that knowledge of the African-American experience would be the last way to destroy the chains of slavery, and so he made it his life's passion. In early 20th century America, it was popularly accepted that blacks in Africa had contributed nothing to world civilization, that slavery actually benefited those Africans who had the good fortune to be caught up in the slave trades.
It was damaging African Americans because they too were being exposed to these ideas and accepted them as truth, and it had a damaging effect on their self-esteem and their belief in their themselves to be able to go on and educate and contribute to the world.
Those kinds of distortions not only permeated the world of white Americans, but sunk deeply into the souls of African Americans. If one was to believe these lies about his own people, then how could he achieve the confidence to break the mold? In 19 books and dozens of published articles, Carter G. Woodson worked to erase that false history and began to help all Americans of all cultures to understand the true history of the African people's experience in America and across the world.
When you think of black people as inferior, it would only make sense, this argument that they had done nothing to contribute to the world. So he's going to point out all of those fallacies and really try to give the black community a rallying point around which to push their efforts, that we really needed to do something to make people aware, not just black people, but white people, about all of the contributions that people of African descent, both on the continent of Africa and also in this country, have made to the world and to the United States of America.
He believed that hard facts, through research and fair-mindedness, would bring balance to history, and that his thesis was that all peoples in the world had made a contribution to civilization. And once that people on a mass scale understood this, there would be greater respect for all races, all ethnic groups, all religions.
Before Carter Woodson began publishing his own writings and those of contemporary historians, there were few media outlets that would shed light on the full story of African and African-American achievements in the United States. He made sure Americans heard a different side of the story. In 1926, Woodson founded Negro History Week, which later evolved into Black History Month. To this day, the occasion continues to remind all Americans of the great accomplishments of writers, entrepreneurs, civil rights leaders, artists, and educators who helped create modern America. Woodson also founded what is now called the Study of African American Life and History, founded in 1915. This is the agency that decides on the theme for Black History Month each year. This legacy is still helping to inspire new generations of young people with true stories of outstanding achievements by Americans of African descent.
No person can imagine where he's going unless he knows where he's been.
The more I learn, as I've continued to educate myself and to study about people like James Lafayette, like Anthony Johnson, like Maggie Walker, it's an absolute inspiration to me because not only did they look like me, but because here you have an individual with enough character, enough strength, enough skill that living in some very difficult times, they were able to use what they had, no excuses, no pity parties, but use what they had to advance their cause and take not only themselves but other people to another level.
Across our country today, African Americans have overcome terrible lies and stereotypes to achieve great success. Carter Woodson inspired each of these people to understand the success that has been achieved by pioneers of their culture and the contributions they have made and are now making to our nation.
In a time when the strategy of Jim Crowism was to dehumanize and discredit those who were different from what was considered the mainstream of America, Dr. Woodson stood up and subsequently changed the course of history.
Dr. Woodson started the association in 1915 at the height of the ascendancy of the Ku Klux Klan. When lynchings were rampant in the United States of America, when racism was part and parcel of American ideology.
Well, of course, there were the obstacles of bigotry and of racism
and of denial.
Large numbers of white Americans simply could not believe that African Americans had made anything like contributions.
Carter G. Woodson was born on December 19, 1875, in Buckingham County, Virginia. He was the son of former slaves James Henry and Eliza Riddle Woodson. He was the youngest of nine children and had to work on the farm rather than attend school.
Let me show you the man who managed to get a Ph.D. from Harvard, only the second man after W.E.B. Du Bois, who was denied his own education and didn't get formal education until he was 20 years old. He was a remarkable human being, an extraordinary intellect.
And so he sought in every way possible to represent African Americans as people who had made enormous, significant contributions to the development of this country.
However, Dr. Woodson was determined to get an education, and at age 17 he moved to Huntington, West Virginia, and at age 20 he was finally able to enter Douglas High School. In less than 2 years he graduated and went on to enroll at Berea College and also served as principal of his old high school. After earning his degree from Berea College, he then journeyed to the Philippines and taught from 1903 to 1907. While in the Philippines, he took numerous correspondence courses from the University of Chicago, which prepared him for study in Paris at the Sorbonne. Upon returning to the United States, he entered the University of Chicago and earned a bachelor and master's degree in history and Romance Languages in 1908. During the time that Dr. Woodson taught at Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C., he became convinced that something needed to be done about the history of African Americans. African Americans were either being ignored or misrepresented, and Carter G. Woodson was not going to allow that to continue. In 1915, the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History was founded. It was created to promote and preserve African American history and culture. He also founded the Journal of Negro History in 1916 as a tool to get information to the masses. He knew that his research would not be widely distributed in a segregated America, so he took care of that himself. In 1917, Dr. Woodson wrote his first book, The Education of the Negro Prior to 1861. This piece is considered his most important contribution. Because of the difficulty he had in publishing his works, Dr. Woodson founded the Associated Publishers in 1921 to publish books and other information about black life and history. He ultimately wrote or co-wrote 22 books, among them The Negro in Our History and The Miseducation of the Negro. In 1926, Dr. Woodson founded what was called the Negro History Week. It was to expand awareness of the contributions of African Americans to our society and to instill pride in the hearts of black men, women, and children, a celebration that has grown into Black History Month and is embraced and celebrated as a part of the American fabric.
He also launched in 1926 Negro History Week, and he hoped that at least for a week, Americans would, of every stripe, Americans of black and white and brown and gray and whatever, would recognize the fact that African Americans were truly Americans, and that this country owed African Americans a great debt for what they had done to make this country what it is today.
Shouts out to Central State University, Hunter Hall, checking in the show on this Carter G. Woodson Black History Month kickoff. Got a lot of texts and chats in saying it's the whole show on Carter G. Woodson. Not necessarily. I'm just choosing to kick it off with Carter G. Woodson because he's the reason why we have Black History Month. Now, I'm going to be dealing in a lot of black history icons during this time period. Booker T. Washington, Frederick Douglass, Medgar Evers, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, a lot of people which I can squeeze in the 28-day period that we have. We're going to continue this on after this break because I am not having no commercial breaks. I'm going to just play my little Dorothy Tillman break. This is the break I play at 8:30. I got 5 minutes into the game, but this is the song I play for my little lady that she can hear before she can go to bed. Because honestly, my little lady snapped me out of a trance that I had at the halftime of the Super Bowl. You know, I was like everybody, me and my son, Ginger, were checking out, like, man, check out Beyonce. Oh, she's popping it. My little daughter said, Daddy, she's dancing inappropriate. I don't want to watch it. And then my grandma looked at me like, man, but we'll deal with that at the halftime show. Let me take a little break right now.
And now, the mellow sounds of Jimmy Irvin.
I don't do no harm. I never meant to make you cry. You were the only one I've ever loved in my life.
I can't do it no more. I can't sing no more sad songs. One, two, three, hit me. Bop, bop, bop it out of bebop. Bop, bop, yeah, bass man. Come on up. One, two, three, hit me. Sound good. Yeah, saxophone on the floor. One, two, three, hit it.
Those of us living in the United States who see ourselves as and who are in fact, you know, descendants of the Africans who were brought to this country, who were enslaved, I mean, and who are rebelling and revolting now against our oppressive condition, and we are concerned about Africa. We see Africa as our motherland, and we feel that we have a responsibility to speak with as much passion as any other African on this issue. The United States government says that change must come in South Africa through peaceful means. That same government has over 500,000 troops in Vietnam fighting not white people, but brown Vietnamese.
So it is small wonder that the civil rights movement was also subjected to heavy attack by Hoover. Billions of government dollars were spent in this direction. Many of these activities were not only unwarranted, but of questionable legality. The congressional hearings into the assassination of Dr. King bore this out. Two FBI agents testified before a Senate committee chaired by Senator Frank Church.
I'm trying to find out what it was that impelled some part of the FBI to pursue Martin Luther King with such an obsession. And what I understood that answer to be is, first of all, it was not any suspicions of the commission of a federal crime. None of the literature showed up a single suggestion that Martin Luther King had committed or was about to commit a crime. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes, sir, but at this point, much of what was being done did involve challenges to local laws. And there is a very strong suggestion that King was seen as rallying the lawbreakers and would-be lawbreakers, albeit for a cause that sounded pure. Looking now in terms of, if we look at what might have gotten the Bureau started, and if we remember at the same time he is extremely critical of the Bureau's own law enforcement efforts, we see throughout these documents and the New Left documents that it is taboo to criticize the Bureau, right, and particularly the director.
Well, was he ever charged with fomenting violence? Did he ever participate in violence? Was it ever alleged that he was about to be violent?
That was the very opposite of his philosophy, Senator.
So that it was neither the fear of commission of a crime or the commission of violence. Was there any serious charge that he himself was a communist?
No such charge ever was made.
So that what was left then was a decision on the part of some persons or person within the FBI that he should nevertheless be pursued.
And replaced.
And the basis for that apparently was political. The decision that he was dangerous or potentially dangerous to someone's notion of what this country should be doing, and a further theory that the FBI possessed the ability to enter into this field and to investigate and to intimidate and seek to neutralize and indeed replace a civil rights leader that they thought to be politically unacceptable. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. And the tactics they used apparently had no end. Microphonic surveillance of hotel rooms. They included informants. They included sponsoring of letters signed by phony names to relatives and friends and organizers. They involved even plans to replace him with someone else the FBI was to select as a national civil rights leader. Is that correct?
Yes, that plan didn't get very far.
But it was seriously considered, and Mr. Hoover penned a note to that suggestion commending its authors, did they not?
Yes.
All right. It also included an indirect attempt to persuade the Pope not to see him.
And many other people.
A direct attempt to persuade one of our major universities not to grant him a doctorate degree.
That's correct. After the March on Washington, there was an acceleration. He was defined because of his speech in that demonstration in Washington as the most dangerous and effective leader in the country. and there was a paper battle between within the Bureau as to how best to attack him, and he was attacked. After Time magazine named him as Man of the Year, again, the Bureau finds that reprehensible, believes it must attack and destroy. When he was given the Nobel Prize, again, they seek to discredit Dr. King with the persons who welcomed him back from that award. When he began to speak out against the Vietnam War, there's a new crescendo of efforts by the Bureau to discredit and destroy Dr. King.
It is my feeling that the assassination of Dr. King was a part of a conspiracy in the country, and I do believe that some individuals in very high places of our government were involved in this conspiracy. And it is the same conspiracy that eliminated and destroyed President Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and so many other freedom and human rights individuals.
I'm convinced the government was involved at some level. I will never separate the conduct, the attitude of Hoover and the FBI from Dr. King's assassination. I never will do that.
I think one of the most important things that come out in that investigation was that Martin Luther King in Memphis was in a white hotel, and the FBI admitted that they leaked to the press that Dr. King was staying in a white hotel instead of a black hotel, and it was that embarrassment that forced Dr. King to move into the Lorraine Hotel where he was killed.
There are more questions regarding the FBI's role in the assassination of Dr. King. For example, why was Dr. King stripped of his protection just before he was killed in Memphis? Reporter Les Payne and myself interviewed police officer Ed Reddit of the Memphis Police Department, who told how he was mysteriously removed from his security post near Dr. King. However, later, his superior, Chief Holloman, denied doing so.
Why do you feel you were pulled away from your assignment of surveillance that day? Why do you think they pulled you away?
I think because whoever pulled the trigger, I could identify.
When there were complaints from somebody, did we reduce manpower at the Lorraine? Did we reduce manpower in
no.
the area?
No.
The attorneys general in 1965 had for 25 years authorized wiretaps in a fairly widespread fashion. This was just one. At the very most, the only thing I can think of that I would have done, but I didn't even do that, was go talk to Bob Kennedy and ask him about it. But Mr. Katzenbach, in whom I also had great confidence, without giving me the details, said that it was all right, that he had, that there were no, it was not being done anymore, it would not be done anymore, and that there was just nothing to worry about.
I think the issue is the neo-fascist police state mentality that pervaded the intelligence community, that is a danger to America to this day.
Malcolm X was kept under heavy FBI surveillance since he got out of prison back in 1953. As he rose to national prominence as the black Muslims' chief spokesman, he became aware that he was under close watch.
Our desire, our prayer, that we can have a peaceful, intelligent rally here this afternoon. But at the same time, we see that they have surrounded us with many of their own agents in uniform and out of uniform.
That surveillance escalated into the infiltration of the Nation of Islam. Personal frailties were played upon, jealousy arose, and Malcolm was ultimately ousted from that organization. This caused an intense climate of rivalry that set the stage for Malcolm's assassination in February of 1965.
He was really declared a hypocrite at the time. And because of some of the things that he was saying in regards to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, may God be pleased with him, a strong position was really taken against him. The ministers, began to speak out against the things that Malcolm was saying in regards to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, accusations that he had made about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He had accused the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, for instance, of fathering children and et cetera. And you must understand that at that time, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, to the Muslims then, was held in such high reverence as you would even think of any prophet being held in high reverence. And this is the kind of love and admiration that the Muslims at that time had for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So when Minister Malcolm began to say those things, it was taken as an outright lie. I would say that, take for instance, one time in the Muhammad Speaks at that time, the newspaper printed a big article concerning the chief hypocrite. And it actually had a picture of Malcolm's head, you know, rolling or bouncing down the street at that time. And, you know, the way that picture is depicted, you know, he has little horns on his head and things like this here. So indirectly, I would say that a very, very strong position was taken against him.
Yes, he's immoral. You can't take nine teenage women and seduce them and give them babies and not tell me and then tell me you're moral. You could do it if you admitted you did it and admitted that the babies were yours. I'd shake your hand and call you a man, a good one too. But anytime you seduce teenage girls and make them be charged with adultery, make them hide your crime, why, you're not even a man, much less a divine man. So, and this is what he did. He took at least nine that we know about. And I'm not speculating, because he told this to me himself. Yes, that's why he wanted me dead, because he knew that as soon as I woke up, I'd tell it.
Plan of action was basically what took place. Me and Leon, we took seats down in the front of the Audubon, became early. We would drift into the Audubon. If indeed there was a search, then we could never enter. There was no search, so we drifted in just like we had hoped to. Leon Davis and myself took seats down front on the left-hand side. Benjamin and William, who carried the sort of shotgun, sat right behind us, you know. And Wilbur sat somewhat in the back, or almost in the middle. And our plan was, as soon as brother came out to speak, that Wilbur would throw the smoke bomb to make a distraction, and that William would fire his shotgun, and that Leon and myself, we would fire our weapons, and then this break for the door.
And without any further ado, I bring before you the Minister Malcolm, and I pray that you and I will listen, hear, and understand. Thank you.
As in Dr. King's assassination, a police superior has trouble with the truth. He tells reporters that two suspects were arrested at the Audubon. Later, official police reports say that one was arrested. Also, listen closely as the police official carefully handles the question about police on the scene.
We have two suspects in custody now.
Where were they arrested?
I wouldn't know that at this time.
Where were they arrested, sir?
One of these men was arrested on the street by one of our patrolmen close by.
There were no police at this meeting, were there, Inspector?
There were no uniformed policemen assigned inside this ballroom.
No uniform police on the scene. Does this mean that police out of uniform were there? And if so, why didn't they take action? What were they doing there? This behavior pattern rings a bell of striking similarity with the behavior pattern of the CIA overseas.
The church committee produced cables, demanded and got cables, which proved it traced the CIA's plan to kill Lumumba. Sid Gottlieb got on a plane and went to Leopoldville. Headquarters sent a cable saying, use the poison. Gottlieb was couriering for the poison. Headquarters sent a cable saying, you have to use it promptly because it deteriorates. And they had a plan to try and get it into his toothpaste or give it to him in a Mickey at some social function. And then there's a gap, no cables, no explanation of what happened. Then 5 weeks later, he's beaten to death on an airplane. And unfortunately, though, the airplane was in the control of people who had agency cryptonyms. And the gap of what happened has never been answered. The men who were involved and were responsible obviously aren't speaking out, and there's no paper to prove anything.
So perhaps the same tactics were used against the civil rights movement. Heavy infiltration of the ranks, spread the seeds of dissension, then step back and let the blood spill.
As I see it, Mr. Chairman, is for this committee to be able to figure out how to persuade the people of this country that indeed it did go on, and how shall we ensure that it never happen again. But it will happen repeatedly unless we can bring ourselves to understand and accept that it did go on. And I say that as one who worked as a United States attorney with the Bureau and have enormous respect for its capacities in the field of kidnapping, bank robbery, and a lot of other things, but am appalled to learn what if it's correct, the intelligence side of that Bureau was up to for so long.
If we would like to believe that the FBI would do all this viciousness and all of these things to an individual and would stop short of killing him, then we're out of our mind. In America today, if we believe the CIA would deal with foreign assassinations and would not consider it at home, that's like saying the mafia runs crooked gambling tables in South America, but honest ones in America. It just ain't true.
We've seen then how the decade of struggle ended. Many of the prominent figures like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were assassinated amidst an intense climate of hatred that government agencies were acutely aware of. In fact, the FBI contributed to creating the climate of hate. Moreover, the assassinations themselves appear to have been facilitated by an elaborate network of government and police agencies who were watching very closely every move that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were making. And then at the same time, they disappeared just as the assassinations occurred. But those were the leaders. What about the students, the troops of the movement? Well, they too were subjected to harassment. This document that you're looking at now shows how the FBI tried to divide factions within the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the Black Panther Party was also subjected to heavy, heavy surveillance.
We knew the history of the FBI's infiltration tactics in other organizations, particularly the American Communist Party. There was already a record compiled that showed that the FBI was even in charge of various branches of the Communist Party. So we understood that police tactic of infiltration. There was a situation where, in a sense, white racism was its own victim. Like, for racist reasons, J. Edgar Hoover had not recruited black agents. He had a lot of white agents. And it takes time to train some black agents. In the meantime, those white agents, try as they might, were not able to infiltrate our ranks because the Black Panther Party did not have any white members. And we relied upon people that we knew. And we kept people that we didn't know on another level. And I think this is why we didn't suffer more that way, because they did catch up and start a crash program of recruiting black agents, and they very quickly filled that gap, but it took them about a year to do it.
In the summer of 1978, I interviewed a man who worked as an informer for the FBI during the 1960s. His name is Dothard Perry, also known as Ed Riggs, also known as Bill Perry, also known as Othello.
How were you paid?
The pay was always in cash. Cash, and you would sign a card. It would go like this. A rendezvous or a drop-off point would be picked out either by yourself or the agent. You would meet the agent there. Usually it would be in a vehicle. You get in the vehicle, he would hand you the money. He would tell you first to count the money. He would tell you the amount while you counted it. If the amount was there, he would then bring out a card. On that card would be for the week of such and such. In other words, the week was dated. So-and-so has been paid the amount of. Then you would sign the card, and then the agent would sign the card. The reason for this is that if all of a sudden the IRS became very interested about where you were getting all this extra money from, you could always tell them to go back to the Bureau, and the Bureau would have your cards on file.
I see. Were there such things as bonuses?
Oh, yes.
What were they paid for?
Bonuses were paid for, suppose while you were meeting with, or you were at a meeting with Bobby Seals, Chulai of the Red Army happened to come to the meeting too, which is something which would be a new development. That's bonus time.
In other words, a hot piece of information.
Hot piece, very hot piece.
Did you ever suffer pangs of conscience?
Quite a few times. Quite a few times. I still suffer pangs of conscience. I suffer from the fact that a lot of people trusted me, and I misused that trust. I suffer from the fact that a lot of information that I gave out was the undoing of certain groups or certain people. I suffer from the fact that I'm on the run constantly. I have no real life to speak of.
You have no family life, really? You have a wife?
No, I don't have a wife. I do have a child. I can't see her that often. I have to stay away from them because once I come around, the Bureau shows up and harassment starts. I have very few close personal friends, no one to really confide in. It's like being on the outside of a glass jar and everything is happening inside the jar, but you're on the outside. You can see it happening, but you can't participate.
Why have you decided to talk to me?
For the simple reason, I think this information should be put out to the public. I think not only black people, but everyone should become aware of what your so-called law enforcement agencies do to so-called enforce the law. Because between you, myself, and the audience, I've seen more felons in law enforcement than I have in prison.
Many would say, well, look, you yourself just got through saying that the DLA was involved in criminal activity. What's wrong with wanting to put them in prison? How would you answer them?
I would answer them this way. First off, we have to understand why they did what they did. But I'm not even going to go off into that psychological hoo-ha. What I'm going to say is when you become just as bad as the people that you go after, then there's nothing gained and a whole lot lost.
You also were active in the infiltration of many cultural groups. Before we go into that step by step, how much research and study did the FBI engage in of black culture in the late 60s?
A great amount.
Give me an idea.
From the thing is, I can they have a file on every type of magazine that blacks read. They have a file on the music.
Music?
Music, dance, theater, actors, comedians, you name it, man.
And they would actually study these different...
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely.
What would they do with music?
To understand the people, you have to understand the culture. To infiltrate, you have to understand. You had a lot of so-called white liberals that were infiltrating the so-called black groups using the information that they had gathered from the studies of blacks.
You mean just to understand the behavior pattern of our people?
Oh, yeah. I can, you know, Will Heaton could name out some jams of Miles Davis that I hadn't even heard of. He could name off some books that I hadn't even read pertaining to black culture.
Do you ever see agents actually studying music of...
Yes, yes. Yes, I've seen them going over even video portion of cultural events. The understanding, like when, okay, you have an organization like Leroy Jones Black House. You remember that. Okay, Leroy Jones's place, which was done on the thing of tribalism. That's where I first heard the word Kintu, Mantu, Huntu, Hintu. These words of the African continuum. I learned that from an agent. He ran it down to me. They make in-depth studies of the personalities of the people they're dealing with too. Culturally, it always helps when you. It's the thing of. You can take their culture and use it against them.
How large would you say an extensive collection on our culture would you say the FBI has? Would you rate it as large as a particular library, like the Schomburg Library in Harlem? Or?
I would rate it better. I would rate it better, and the fact is that they go into details that we probably would overlook. Will Heaton used to meet me in different places. You know, Will Heaton, that was one of my supervising agents. There is a certain bar in the Los Angeles area where people into black cultural things met, and Will Heaton used to meet me there. And he would go into very long and tiring conversations with some very articulate brothers about culture, African culture, and Afro-American culture.
Tell me about some of the cultural organizations that you infiltrated and what you did.
PATHLA, Mafunde, Watts Writers Workshop, which they had...
The Watts Writers Workshop?
Yes. Watts Writers Workshop, which was one of the oldest established black writers workshop.
That place was burned down.
Yeah. The bureau had it burnt down.
How do you know that?
I know because I participated. I did the arson.
You burned down the Watts Writers?
Yes.
Why did they want it to go?
At the time, funding had been cut to the workshop, had been cut out, but it looked like there was a possibility of a grant being given back to the workshop. And if there was no theater, there would be no grant.
How did you do it?
Two cans of kerosene, a Purex bottle, gasoline, and a flare, highway flare.
Why didn't you use more sophisticated stuff?
Oh, No. You're never overly sophisticated. It's too obvious. this way you make it look like, you know, maybe somebody in the neighborhood that got kicked out of theater at one time got mad and came and burned the damn theater up, that kind of thing.
But you were involved in this theater? I mean, didn't get to you at all what you were...
Hey, man, that got to me a great deal. I love that theater. I built the stage.
You built the stage?
Oh, yeah. When I got to the workshop, the stage that had been... The original stage that had been built needed an extension on it. The original part of the stage was in terrible condition. They had no lighting system. I put the lighting system in myself. I put the stage in myself, and that was a stage, man. And that was a theater. It's a nice theater.
Who was the director of that workshop?
Harry Dolan.
Harry Dolan. Some very, very well-known artists supported that workshop, gave money to it.
Some very well-known artists came out of the Watts Writers Workshop. You know, Glenn Tubman, Yaphet Kotto, Sidney Poitier used to come down there and give a class. Sammy Davis Jr. used to come down there all the time. Quincy Jones used to come there and give music classes. We had our own 8-track studio set up for sound. We had our own sound room there.
Was part of your other activities and responsibilities to study the profiles of celebrities who were supportive of organizations?
Definitely, and especially, like I said, psychological backgrounds, weaknesses and strengths. Did he have a weakness for blondes? Did he have a weakness for money? Did he snort cocaine? Did he smoke marijuana? They even get into, oh, and that's one thing the Bureau loves, is their sexual background. They have files and files on different blacks, not only celebrities, but a lot of others, sexual activity.
What would they do with this information?
Oh, that's used as a weakness.
So they would feed these weaknesses?
Yes.
Did you see that happen?
Oh, yes. Doc Holliday, who is one of the leaders of the BGF, Black Gorilla Family, which is a prison gang in the California state prison system. Upon his release from prison, a certain sister made herself known to him at a nightclub, whereupon he moved in with her, and she picked up names, telephone numbers, information, you know, that kind of thing. That lasted for a good 3.5 months.
Was this an unusual thing, or did this happen often?
No, that happens all the time.
Did you yourself get involved in doing that?
Yes.
Give me an example.
There was a gentleman that was on trial in Los Angeles that belonged to the BLA that had been busted in a southern state for a bank robbery, but was brought with two other people to Los Angeles to stand trial for the machine gunning of a police officer in Los Angeles. I was supposed to worm my way into the affections of his sister and whatever it took to get the information that I needed as far as what kind of defense they planned to use as to turn this information over to the federal prosecution.
Did you do it?
I got the information, and thank God I didn't have to go through with the actual thing of sexual activity.
What do you mean, thank God?
The sister was rather unappealing.
How did you justify to the organizations in which you had infiltrated yourself that you were living on an $800 a week stipend or on an $800 a week standard of living when most of them were living hand to mouth?
Well, hey, brother, you know, I'm hustling, you know. I mean, hey, man, you know, sell a little of this on the side, a little of that on the side. You know, I get over, you know, that kind of thing. In other words, ain't nobody's business but mine where I get the money. So, you know, everybody took it for granted that I was possibly doing a little dealing on the side. that kind of thing. Then also, everybody liked me for the simple reason that I would do things that I didn't have to do. I would go out of my way. You know, like Mafundi would have a pageant and they needed someone to do the sound setup for him, and I'd say, of course, I'll do it for you. You know, that kind of thing. I was very well liked at one time in the community.
Would you say to American citizens that this situation of surveillance and infiltration continues to this day?
Oh, yes.
On the dimension that you experienced?
Probably much larger by now.
Larger?
Oh, yeah. Let me put it to you like this. Each year, everything gradually escalated up more and more. So I figure when I left, it didn't stop escalating. As they say, one monkey does not stop anybody's show.
You mentioned Sammy Davis Jr., who at one time, it was reported, gave money to the Black Panther Party, I believe. Were you ever assigned to look into that?
Yes, I was told to try to get as close to Mr. Davis or to anyone in his office as I could. I used to go up and have real chit-chat, chummy-chummy conversations with his personal secretary, Ann, at the 9000 building on Sunset. And I used to bring a Portapak video camera, and I used to go around and I would videotape the whole office.
You mean celebrities would be coming into his office and you'd film them freely?
Oh, yeah.
Didn't they question that?
I'm from the Ross Writers Workshop. Yeah, right on, brother, you know, that kind of thing. No questions asked. Same thing with the NAACP Image Awards. You know, they were very interested in people like Sammy Davis Jr. There was another black in Los Angeles that they were very interested in because, not Los Angeles, but in Sacramento, Nathaniel Colley, who's attorney for the NAACP. And I know Nat. And they wanted information on him just for the simple reason that he's an attorney for the NAACP, which makes no sense to me, but must make a lot of sense to them because they use the information.
You've been called upon to testify in Washington. Before who?
Before the Senate committee. I was called first to testify before the church committee. And I did go to Washington, D.C. I did testify to those people. And I want to say right now that the committee was full of smack. They got loads and loads of information and didn't even use it, didn't release it. I had tapes that I offered to them in evidence against the Federal Bureau of Investigation with conversations of me and my supervising officer. Where he's telling me to obtain certain articles for him by stealing. Don't get fingerprints on it. We can really use that. Did you take the weapons over to such and such? The Church's committee told me that they couldn't use the tapes because the tapes were gotten by illegal means.
What would you say about the composition of the committee panel that questioned you?
I can say that's for the birds, too, because the same people that I was talking about were the same people on the panel with the church's committee.
What do you mean?
When I came in the room to be interviewed by the so-called people from the church's committee, the representatives from the Federal Bureau of Investigation were also in the room.
FBI agents were a member of the church committee panel?
They were there with the investigators for the church's committee asking questions just like the church's committee. And see, this is another thing that I find fault with, and this is another reason why I am not going to Washington, D.C., is that, again, I have been asked to come again for the second time. I'm not going again for the simple reason that when I went up there, with the idea that there were agencies investigating the Federal Bureau of Investigation, not the Federal Bureau of Investigation investigating itself.
You're on the lam, almost. Do you have a sense that you're going to be arrested and go to prison?
Oh, yeah, eventually. Eventually, when things come to a head, it has to. has to be that way. No other way around it.
What would you say to citizens who sit and listen to what you've said and have a sense of frustration and helplessness?
There are some agents, the old line agents, that disagree with the tactics that were used during the so-called COINTEL period. But one thing I don't want us to jump off of is that people always talk about, they're talking about COINTEL now so heavily. I'm not talking about COINTEL. I'm talking about a thing called BD, which was better known as Black Desk. The Black Desk was set up for a simple thing of infiltrating black organizations and black groups, whatever.
Where was this Black Desk, or were there a number of them?
There were a number of Black Desks, but the head Black Desk was in Washington, D.C., controlled by Sullivan. And the...
Was he black?
No.
Mm-hmm. And what was the function of the Black Desks all over the country? I guess there were dozens.
The function of the Black Desk was to monitor activity, social unrest, revolutionary groups, cultural groups, and such in the black community.
And feed it into this central desk. And it still exists?
As far as I know, yes.
We've seen a number of investigations into the assassination of Martin Luther King. We've seen an extended police trial of the assassination of Malcolm X. What you seem to say substantiates what many black people say out on the street, that government agents or agencies knew that these assassinations were brewing and either participated in them or allowed them to take place.
It would behoove black people, it would behoove all people, really, to question so-called the cut and dry one lone assassin theory. The Bureau and other intelligence agencies are very good at conspiracies. They are very good at setting people up to be killed. They are very good at making innuendos so the person will be killed.
City police don't know about it because they have policemen in there. They don't let black people form anything without some policemen in there. And while I was in the black Muslim movement, over the black Muslim movement, many of the police who were sent to infiltrate us, they're black, would tell me, say, look, I'm a cop, but I have to come. They would tell me. I knew the Muslim movement was full of police. So don't you think anything is going down that they don't know about? The only thing that goes down is what they want to go down. And what they don't want to go down, they don't let it go down.
Something else was used against the students that drove the final nails into the coffin, killing the movement.
What stopped it, of course, almost dead in its tracks, and not by any accident, was a widespread and deliberately organized widespread use of drugs. The fact that a decision was made, and I think you, most of you familiar with the broadcast of the mafia defector who went on public media to declare what happened and outline in great detail the great plan of how to destroy the black youth of the nation, starting in New York. He said in a meeting 20 miles outside of New York City, the great decision was made. He said he didn't have to guess about it, and those who heard him know that I'm quoting him almost verbatim, because he was there. And the decision was to concentrate the distribution of drugs on the black youth of the nation, starting in New York, beginning in the elementary school, and that to punish, even on the pain of death, any of the distributors who invaded the white community or predominantly white schools. That New York and other large cities were to be divided up into districts. The district commander, black, was to be given any kind of car he wanted, Mercedes, Rolls Royce, anything, because this would be a part of the sales pitch. Said blacks just love fine cars, and he'd drive around through the community in his fine car, and some of his key assistants, and he'd be identified, he'd be known, and that sort of stuff. And so the story's, I'm not going any farther into it. But thus it began, and the spread over the country. And we fell for it. Now, one thing was important. That the thing to attract the blacks, more than any other thing, more than the drug itself, but to spread the word, have a number of key young people in it, and spread the word that this is the end thing. So they'll get them. Just say it's the end thing. And they'll brave the fires of hell to be a part of the end thing.
So that's our story of the decade of struggle. We put together this film to pay particular homage and tribute to the extraordinary young people of that era. And we give the story to our young people of today in particular, in the hope that they'll stop and think about much of the negativism that they're caught up in nowadays. And
turn my headphones up. Louder.
Jesse Jr. In the college Woodson part,
But today is a special day in Black History Month also, because today is none other than Rosa Parks' birthday, the quote-unquote mother of the Civil Rights Movement. Today is her birthday, and I'm going to take this time to pay homage to her and play a little history bio of her. And then I'm going to play a little excerpt of Coffee Chain of Conversation with me with Dr. Claude Anderson as he discussed how black citizens in America are becoming not second-class citizens, but fourth-class citizens. Stay tuned. 347-838-9825. That's 347-838-9825.
Born the eldest of two children in 1913, Rosa Louise McCauley was raised on her grandparents' farm in Pine Level, Alabama. As a child, Rosa was exposed to the realities of segregation. She walked to school daily because the elementary school bus system prohibited black students from riding. Rosa later attended the Alabama State Teachers College High School. However, due to both her grandmother and mother's illnesses, she was forced to drop out. At 19, Rosa met Raymond Parks, who worked with Montgomery's NAACP chapter. After their marriage in 1932 and much encouragement, she earned her high school diploma. Rosa joined Raymond in the NAACP, serving as the chapter's secretary and youth leader.
History is peculiar. It places gifted and talented women and men in situations where they must make a choice. The choice she made was on the afternoon of the 1st of December, 1955, on a bus as she was going home from her seamstress job in a department store in Montgomery, Alabama.
Rosa, along with three other black passengers, were told to give up their seats to a white male passenger. She refused and was arrested. An all-day bus boycott was organized on the day of Rosa's trial, December 5, 1955, where she was fined $14 and found guilty.
She was a role model for courage in the face of racial injustice. Rosa Parks, through her quiet eloquence, through her commitment both to her faith and to the cause of civil rights and racial equality, was prepared to sacrifice everything, her security, even her life, to fight for what was right, at least her perception of what was justice.
Thousands of people walked, carpooled, and took cabs to work. The boycott lasted 381 days, with the 26-year-old Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. as their leader. Rosa was not the first person to refuse to give up her seat. Two other women were previously arrested for the same offense. However, it was this quiet 42-year-old who became the face of the Montgomery bus boycott. In 1956, groundbreaking history was made.
The Supreme Court decision, by a 9-0 vote, supported the civil rights position, calling for an end to racial segregation on municipal buses.
Unable to find work, largely due to her political stance, the Parks moved north to Detroit, Michigan. And by 1965, Rosa began to work for Congressman John Conyers until 1988 when she retired. In memory of her husband and in her vision for a better tomorrow, Rosa co-founded the Rosa and Raymond Parks Institute for Self-Development, which educates young people on the civil rights movement, gives freedom bus tours, and provides youth with professional guidance. Rosa also worked giving lectures and advocating for social justice. Rosa Parks passed away on October 24, 2005. She was the first woman and second African American to lie in honor at the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. Rosa received over 24 honorary doctorates and numerous national and international awards, among them the Medal of Freedom from President Clinton and the Congressional Gold Medal of Honor. Rosa was a grassroots activist for social justice and peace, through her efforts in the civil rights movement to her participation in the anti-apartheid movement for South Africa. Although she never planned on getting arrested, her simple action changed the course of a nation.
I think Mrs. Park unexpectedly had greatness thrust upon her. I think she was born for it, and I do think she achieved it. You see what I mean? But had she not, of that particular day, said, I'm not moving, my feet hurt, we would have a different nation and a different world.
And today, sorry about that, and today is Madam Rosa Parks' birthday. And I'm going to say it again, like the eloquent poet Maya Angelou just said, if she was not tired and didn't decide to give up her seat, what type of world would it be together? What type of world will it be today, excuse me? Now again, everybody, let's say happy birthday to Miss Rosa Parks.
Oh, today is your birthday, and I wish you many, many, many more. Oh, today is a special day, one you never had before. Send you flowers by the hour, candy and perfume. I'm gonna shower you, precious baby, birthday baby, tonight. Oh, today is your birthday. I wish you many, many, many more. It's a special day, one you never had before. I'll send you flowers by the hour, with candy and perfume. I'm gonna shower you, pretty baby, birthday baby, tonight. Thank you.
who got reelected for the first time as the first black American president, Barack Obama, a black man. Let me get shouts out the crowd, please, and my other guests in the chat room. You know, let you in on this, that Jesse Jackson Jr. thing, my man, crowd, please, with how he was typing it up. JJJ wanted to be mayor. That's why he ran his wife for alderman. JJJ looked at being governor, lieutenant governor. He was trying to be some black first. He wanted to be the black first black Speaker of the House because he figured nobody black would be president. You know, he was just trying to be somebody because his daddy said be somebody. Here's the excerpt from Coffee Tina Conversation with Dorothy Tillman. He's got Claude Anderson on it. He's going to talk about the situation of black America. I'm going to play about 10, 15 minutes of it. Let me know what y'all think. Got it loud in Ebony. Okay. I don't know. See, you got it? Wasting time. I see it moving.
Hey, let's just talk about who we are. You know we talked about the guns. They tell us turning our guns and how they're doing everything else. So I'm just going to let you flow for Black History Month. You're going to teach. This is your classroom. And then I'm going to go through here to 7 o'clock, and then up to 8 o'clock, and then I'm going 9 o'clock your time. And then I'm going to go to the phone and take some calls. So let's just talk, Dr. Anderson. Let's teach this morning. Black labor, white wealth, dirty little secret, Second Amendment, Indian lawsuit. Hey, y'all, Professor, the Doctor, Dr. Claude Anderson. This is your classroom. Teach, Dr. Anderson.
Well, first of all, let me say good morning to you and all my friends and supporters in the Chicago area, and any other friends you have, we have across the nation. And I'm delighted you called and invited me to be on your program this morning. Earlier you indicated you heard our good friend Harry Belafonte on the radio last night, on the TV, whatever it was. And anything he said, you should take to heart, because he's a very conscious and committed black person. But one of the things that would stand out in my mind is what the nature of our problems are today. We got two major problems for black folk, and they're locked up into a permanent underclass. And that comes from integration and globalization. So contrary to what anybody tells you, I don't care what comes out of a white mouth or a black mouth, Dorothy, anybody tells you that black folk are progressing, they're lying to you. In proportional comparative terms, we're exactly where we were in 1860 on the eve of the Civil War. We are not progressing. We're going backwards. And black folk must get about the business of trying to figure out how to change some of these things as quickly as they possibly can. And as an underclass, that means an underclass of those individuals, Dorothy, who by the nature of their social economic circumstances are destined to live in the future as either beggars or criminals. We're locked in. We got a small chance of getting out, and we've got to use that chance, exercise that chance. We got to move very quickly. Now, we can talk about anything you want to talk about this morning. I'll run through some of those things for you.
You can run through them as we go. One of the reasons everybody else who get elected represents people, they represent their people. And when I get so sick of black folks mentioning everybody but us and putting us in the middle or in between, nobody else mentions us when they talk about us. Even politically, they have moved way in front of us, building governments and businesses. So, I mean, I want you to just do what you want to do, but you got to teach. We got to wake these black people up so they can know what to do.
That's because they don't understand the nature of our problem. And those people are running away from us, and all those people that don't want to be called black, they're ascribing to the national public policy. That national public policy is not new. Black folks might be unconscious and ignorant of it, but it's not new. That policy first went into effect in 1867, about 2 years after black folk came out of supposed institutional racism and slavery. That public policy was put in effect when blacks began to indicate, based on the 15th Amendment, that they were interested in running for public office. That means anything from the local sheriff to the post office, postmaster, or secure for the House of Representatives. And that public policy said very specifically three things. One, that if you, in fact, you black folk are just newly released from slavery, if you want to get into a public arena, there are three things that you cannot do and would be totally unacceptable. One, you cannot run for a public office on a group-based issue. Talking about groups, because we're going to turn you loose, and you must now prove to us beyond any other elements that you're strictly a successful or committed individual. They knew that if you work strictly as an individual, you'll never be successful. You cannot beat them work functioning as an individual. You cannot operate as a group.
Right.
So you cannot come to the table to group issues. Two, that you cannot come to the table and talk about blackness in any form. That was totally a taboo. You could not talk about black issues. That was told to them in 1867. And three, you you could not come to the table and try to hold white folks accountable for what they've done for black, done to black folk over 360-something years.
That's 2013, isn't it? That's not a 2013
thing. Yeah, well, yeah, that was a public policy put in effect. Now, that public policy was updated in 1971 by Richard Nixon when he received a memo from Senator Monahan, which says that the best way to tone black folks down in this country, whether talking about the civil rights movement or the black power movement, what you must do is to go back to that old public policy in the 1860s. You must take the focus off of black folk and shift it to minority women and children and treat black folk on a public policy of benign neglect.
Yeah.
But benign neglect, Dorothy, means pretend. Pretend that black people do not exist. And in public programs or public policies, do not observe, or do not attend to, or do not address anything that focuses on the needs and the interests of black folk. Make sure that they appear invisible. And so, and now that public policy of benign neglect has morphed and grown up, and now is changed into what we call hateful indifference to black folk. That's why nobody in this country is going to address any issues pertaining to black folk. Not whites, not blacks, not Asians, not American Indians, and not any black leadership, no civil rights organizations, or public officials, or black elected officials. Not one. You have absolutely no black leadership in America of any nation.
That's
you cannot
trust. Local or national. We're talking about across the board.
Doesn't make any difference. You're not going to have one single black person that's going to stand up in any venue, whether it's radio, TV, or in the print, and say, here's what the needs of black folk are, let's address those issues. What they did, they go back to that benign neglect policy, which says pretend that they don't exist, and the policy also stipulated is that give the pretense, listen to Dorothy, give the pretense that somehow if you address the issues of everybody and other groups, so minority women and children, that somehow black people will be miraculously and magically included on a trickle-down basis, a trickle-down theory basis. So you use words like minorities, poor folk, people of color, multicultural, diversity, all this stuff, that which gives the pretense that somehow black folk are included. But what it also does, it gives all these other groups now all these self-perceived and agreed minorities, which never were minorities, it gives them the right then to take all the suffering of black folk, that black folk suffered since 1510 in this country, take all their suffering, the castration, the lynching, the exploitation, the benign neglect, the enslavement, and pretend that they are the people who suffered, not black folk. That's the policy you're under. And every civil rights organization, every black leader in this country going to talk about minorities and people of color. Not one will ever put black folk solely and singly out there. Other groups will. Other groups will talk about their own people and their own needs. They can do it blatantly now because they understand the national public policy. And people like Hispanics. Hispanics will call themselves a minority, even though 95% of them have been in this country less than 25 or 30 years now. 95%.
And Dr. Anderson, they also, on the census form, said that they're white. They check out the white box, too.
Oh, yeah, because Hispanics are basically white speaking Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Arabs are basically white people practicing Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Asians, they extract their own culture. They're on probation to be white. The only people in this country that's not classified as white are black folk. The issue never was minority. The issue was always a black and white issue. But the public policy of 1971 allowed everybody to hide and disguise themselves, pretend that somehow they've been affected and aggrieved. That's why now gender has replaced black folk. Handicapped people have replaced black folk. Transsexuals in the country has replaced black folk. And black folk are so darn silly, they'll sit there and be totally displaced and say they're happy because they got somebody black in a public office. They ain't going to do a damn thing for them. A civil rights organization, they're going to talk about multicultural diversity and people of color. I have never in my life felt so downhearted to see black folk get in this condition and is totally abysmally ignorant of what's happening to them and who's putting the pain on them.
And they blame themselves. That's why I was saying, even with the shooting, they're talking about turning your guns. The prison complex of all our people in jail, the fact that our community is just being totally just wiped out. We're the only one. When they got rid of all those folks in public house, I said, there's no other group would have gotten rid of that many folks collectively and say, get rid of them. There's something wrong, Dr. Anderson.
Well, the biggest thing is that you did wrong. You had no business. You had absolutely no business integrating. That's your problem. That's the first problem.
Mm-hmm.
You had no business integrating. The problem in this country. And no disrespect to our great leader, Dr. Martin Luther King, he did the best he could under circumstances, but that's why he told Harry Belafonte that he thought, he said, no, I think we, as black folk, we've integrated into a burning house.
So he's integration. Fighting for equality and desegregation and not
that's
separation.
Right. Right.
We had a new group of Jews who came down to Alabama, and they switched that language to integration.
Right,
we were talking. We want to fight for equality. We were fighting our butts off for equality. That language just got
right.
Tripped on us and switched. I just want that for the record.
But yeah, but keep in mind that the issue, Dorothy, should have never been, and I raised this cane way back in the 60s. The issue never had should have been, do black folk want integration or do you black folk want segregation? That's never the issue. That is a stupid question to ask black folk, because I had a white person ask me that down in the Hilton Hotel in Tallahassee once I came off the stage giving a speech. And when this one white guy said, Dr. Elson, you're confusing us. On one hand, you got Martin Luther King, he wants integration, and you got Malcolm X wants segregation. Which end of the stick do you all want? I said, as a black person, I don't want either end of the stick. I don't want integration or segregation. I want aggregation, as I said in all my books. I want aggregation.
Now, wait, I'm trying to explain to people what aggregation is, because they don't know about power numbers. They need to get your book, Power Numbers, to understand it, but explain it to them.
Right. Well, aggregation means black folks should have the same rights and privileges as all other people to come together at any place on that state, to come together as a group and pool their resources, their power, their money, their votes, pool their votes in their own self-interest. And that's in the betterment of black folk. It's not about integration or segregation. See, they don't ever ask. You never once heard any politician or civil rights group ask Hispanics, do you Hispanics come into America, even though you come here illegally, do you want to be integrated or segregated? We don't ask Asians that. We don't ask Arabs that. We don't ask anybody that. You don't even ask transsexuals that. The only people that ask, do you want integration or segregation, or do you want to go back to segregation, you want to go to get black folk, and black folk are silly enough to go along with that silly question.
But now, see, that goes to reason why these other folks and black folks so easily. When you talk about the post-traumatic slavery syndrome, you talk about slavery, and it goes to your book, Dirty Little Secrets, that we are that, and they're able to manipulate the movement. That's why your books and stuff are so educated.
And see, before we get into further discussion, any of them that are real serious at this point in time, because I'm getting out of the business just trying to entertain black folk. If they're not serious about anything, I'm going to retire and spend my time enjoying my grandkids. I wrote books that covered all these issues, taking it from A to Z, explaining how we got into this condition. And it identified as black labor, white wealth. It laid out in graphic terms and timelines every technique, every strategy, every public law, every custom, every attitude that the dominant white society used to maldistribute almost 100% of all this nation's power, wealth, and resources into the hands of the dominant white society. So that black folk right now do not own and control a sufficient amount of anything to be a competitive people. You cannot compete in this country. It is impossible in theory and practice today. I don't care whether you live in Chicago or Baltimore, Mississippi. If you cannot compete, you're never going to make it. It's not about integration and segregation. It's that you lack any control of anything of material value. You don't have any wealth and power. In this country, we have one half or 1% of the nation's wealth or anything of value in this country. Blacks own one half of 1%. You cannot compete that way. We don't own and produce anything. We're zero producers and 100% consumers. They got you locked in box. And I've told blacks and black labor, white wealth, these are your major problems. And now most of the other books you see all over the country written by black folk, all they are doing is focusing on the darn symptoms. They're not talking about how you eradicate the problem.
Yeah, you're right. Now, Dr. Ezra, you wrote this book about 27 years ago. When I first met you, you just wrote this book. How was this book?
It's about 20 years old now, and it's still one of the best-selling books in this country around the world.
And I recommend Black Label White Wealth, Journal of the Secret, and Power Numbers. Now, one thing, you said we need to pool our resources, but you unlike other people. You're not saying that we're not supposed to make our tax dollars work for us that we give to this country. We're supposed to be able to pool our resources and also utilize the resources for the taxes. Because I heard some black folks say, we don't need the government money. We just need to put our own money. I said, no, those are your taxes. You have a right to that, too. Everybody else is coming in here dealing with that. We have to put together kind of a
whoever told you that is stuck on stupid with Gorilla Glue. That's the first thing that tells you they don't need any governmental assistance or any other resources. That is the basis of the American dream. I hear black folk talking about the American dream and all these other groups. going, coming to America with American dream. And I can't find one darn black to rub with the head with another black to understand what the American dream was about. The American dream was nothing but saying to all those Europeans coming to this country, and now for the other groups coming from the Far East, it says that if you go to America, that we guarantee you that we can give you free land and free labor, and that it would be impossible unless you're stupid that you can't become wealthy and rich. That was the basis of the American dream, coming to America to get free land and free labor and being able to prosper. Everybody came to this country, who every man was eligible for 160 acres of land for homesteading, and but black, except black people. That was the American dream. Now, you still got people coming to America, but instead of getting free land and free labor now, they get free access or affirmative action programs by classifying themselves as a minority. That they're still getting access. That's why if you go look at any minority program in this country, any minority program, black folks might be, you might have a few blacks in it. Most of it is going to other groups. For instance, I did one study of affirmative action programs in Texas, and out of all the resources that went out through contracts with the government and the agencies, guess what? White women got 79%, almost 78% of it. And Hispanics got something like 23% of it. And blacks got 0.9%. You're not getting anything. All you come to Washington, D.C., all the programs are geared to take care of either American Indians, to Asians, Hispanics, women, gays, everything but black folks. Black folks are silly enough to sit back and let it go down.
Which goes back into what's happening with the lawsuit that we went through. I call you the other day, let's go back. What's happening with this Indian lawsuit?
Well, let me articulate first. Then we'll talk about each one of them. See, I can only see, before I get into that, about three things that black folk are going to have to get a shot at to be able to get out of the ditch we're in as an underclass. And that little small opening is going to close up. Somebody's going to plug that little hole pretty soon. And the underclass, when you're locked on the bottom, you're never going to get out. That's in Chicago, too. The blacks in Chicago can hang it up if they don't.
And I'm going to continue the rest of this tomorrow. If you want to hear the rest of my man, Dr. Claude Anderson, is talking about crowd please. I feel you with your chat in the chat room, what's going on in Detroit. We kind of let a lot of our stuff slip by not putting our resources together. And I agree with you. We need to leave the Democratic Party because it's not really giving us no power because we are lock, stock, and barrel on one party. You had A.C. Hastings complaining that Barack Obama did not even acknowledge not one of the 62 appointments that they sent, the Black Caucus sent to him, and that the simple fact that he spent $1 million while raising $1 billion on black media. I'm just not talking about Ebony and Jet, but all the black radio stations around America. You think I split $1 million with all the black radio stations around the whole America, all the print media, all the newspapers, magazine, got to fight for $1 million and have $1 billion? But that's what I'm saying on those things right there. But, you know, it's how we look. It's how we look at what we have. And I decided to play in the show with Claude Anderson to give an alarming wake-up call of what's happening. I started the show with Carter G. Woodson because I wanted everybody to know why we are celebrating African-American History Month. And people always complain about why blacks are in the situation that we are in, given all of the accomplishments that we made back in those times. And that's why I played the FBI infiltrating the black movement so we can understand what happened. Jesse Jackson Jr. being wearing a wire, being an agent. Like he said, if you listen to the man who was an agent, he said, you go to some of these organizations and the head organizations are already the FBI, already the agent. They just waiting for people to come in and give them stuff. And the so-called black desk that he talked about where they got agencies of black organizations already in the areas to spy on the community, to report back to what's going on, to quell dissension. I mean, come on. But I'm not gonna deal with that. on Wednesday's show, I'm gonna do a special on Paul Robeson, and I have someone from Ronnie Strokes from All Sports Incorporated. I hope I'm saying your business right, Ronnie. So we're going to talk about the situation in concussions and athletic sports and young sports because he recruits high school players to go to all colleges and all major sports. Tuesday, I'm going to continue the little play and talk on Dr. Claude Anderson. And I might play a little more infiltration of the FBI, but I'm basically going to deal with Frederick Douglass and Medgar Evers a little bit during the first half. I'm sorry if I didn't get that Beyonce part in. I might squeeze that in tomorrow. Listen, this is Jim Lee's Underground Radio Network. Hey, thank you, crowd. Please, for being in the building. You too, Guest 107, and all the other people that logged in and logged out. I got to see y'all tomorrow. Good night, and may your God be with you. See you tomorrow.
And no money for the gold down there.
Yeah.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on,
yeah.
Hold on.
Chicago, the Jacksons came in and ran rough shots, and now we got to clean their mess up. Now all the black leadership is gone. They did to black leadership what the cops did to the gang by taking the head of the snakes. Now you got all these little pieces running around trying to be leaders and can't even lead themselves out of paper bag. Good night again.